I hope, for example, that I've given my kids a really unique start in life. They speak three languages fluently. They've got friends from different cultures. And also, I suppose that they have a sense that home can be anywhere as long as they're surrounded by love. So I guess, in summary, it is all worth it, if you do have a sense of adventure.
From our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with The Listen, exploring the subtleties of culture and compassion in every conversation. Today, we kick off season 21, a series of interviews focusing on motherhood. We'll be talking with the founder of MomAbroad.com, the host of the podcast Mamas in Training, and a life and loss coach who helps families dealing with the loss of a child. My guest today is Carrie Frace, a British-born journalist who has lived in Barcelona for the last 20 years. She currently co-runs three companies, including Mom Abroad, one of Europe's leading online resources for international families. Carrie was one of the founders of Bermain in Spain, which campaigned against Brexit and now supports the rights of British citizens within the EU. During the pandemic, Carrie edited and contributed a chapter to her first book, an anthology called Hashtag Living the Dream, Expat Life Stripped Bare, which challenges some of the stereotypes about life away from home. Welcome to the show, Carrie. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Kate, for having me on.
I'd like to begin with Hashtag Living the Dream, the anthology we mentioned in the intro. Your contribution begins with you receiving the news of your mother's death. This is a moment that I have not had to go through yet. I can only imagine how painful it was for you and for anyone who's in that position. But I'm curious if you think your experience was affected by the fact that you were not living in the UK at the time, that you were already living abroad.
Hugely, hugely affected by that. The guilt that comes with not being with my mother in the weeks leading to her death will stay with me, sadly, forever. She died suddenly from a heart attack, and I couldn't work out why she'd not said anything to me in the weeks leading up to her death. And after she died, I accessed her emails and I saw some correspondence she'd had with her sister in which she talked about feeling unwell. And she never told me about it, nor my dad really, which was really typical of her. She was very stoic, very sort of British in that respect. But I do feel that if I had been living closer to her at the time, I would have insisted that she had got some kind of medical attention. I realised that, this is difficult for me to say, but I do actually realise that our connection was not as strong as it would have been if I had lived in the same country. And when I travelled back that night to my parents' house to be with my dad, he told me how much my mum had wished to see more of me, but couldn't. And that was really tough to hear. But she never made me feel guilty. I mean, she always was someone that believed that people should live the life they wanted to. But what it has done, I think, is definitely made me think about where my children will end up living and how much I'd probably want to be near them. So yes, in answer to your question, it did affect me.
Do your children have a strong connection to the UK?
Not hugely. They have never lived in the UK. They were both born in Barcelona. And one thing I think that particularly my eldest has struggled with is the question, where are you from? Because she is different in the fact that she speaks perfect English, but she also speaks perfect Spanish and Catalan. And she's got British parents. And she'll ask me and she'll say, Mummy, what shall I say? And, it's not a one word answer. And kids of that age, they just want a one word answer, don't they? They just want to say, I'm from wherever. So I think when she's older, she'll be able to say, I'm from Barcelona. But it's a bit confusing now. She's not quite sure where she's from. I think she they both would like to be one thing or the other. But there, you know, going back to your original question, yes, they do have links to the UK, but perhaps not as strong, especially now I don't have either my parents, not as strong as I perhaps like them to have.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such an interesting question. In fact, just this weekend, my son and I were in the car alone, and I can't quite remember how it came up, but I said, you know, how do you identify?
Mm.
Like what, I mean, I'm not saying you have to put a label on yourself, but if someone were to ask you, you know, not necessarily where are you from, but what are you, you know?
Yes. Well, I think that's a better question, isn't it? What are you? I think that's more interesting because it shouldn't really matter where you're from, but it's an obvious question that we ask each other. It's a kind of icebreaker,
right?
Isn't it?
Well, because...
But actually, it's much more interesting
to say what are
you. Well,
because most people have that round peg that they can easily put in a round hole, don't they?
Yeah.
I was stunned when he immediately had an answer. He said, well, I was, you know, raised in Spain by an American mother and a Spanish father.
Wow.
So, I mean, I suspect that will evolve as he, I mean, it's the truth that that's like the bare bones of his existence so far. But this subject leads me to my next question, which is, I wonder what, you know, speaking of your mother, speaking of your children, because this is a series on motherhood, and you and I are in that generation where we're both mothering and, you know, in my case, my mom is still alive. In your case, your mom, you know, you've lost your mom, but until very recently, you were still being mothered in a certain way, you know? So I'm wondering what parts of your relationship with your own mother you've chosen to take into your relationship as a mother, and what aspects of that relationship, if any, have you consciously decided not to continue with?
Mm. I think it's a very interesting question, and there's not a straightforward answer really for that. I mean, we're all unique, mm-hmm. aren't we, as mothers? And growing up, we only have one role model, our mothers. And I suppose looking at my childhood, I look back at my mum, and she was definitely someone who believed in education, integrity, and equality. And I think those values she's definitely instilled in me. They're definitely three values that I do adhere to. She'd never sweated the small stuff, which I don't. I'm kind of like, I think there's so much bad stuff in the world going on. I'm very relaxed in that stuff because she was very philosophical. She was laid back. But having said that, consciously, perhaps what I haven't done, she was of a generation, I think, that I alluded to earlier, quite stoic, quite perhaps not sentimental. It's not that my brother and I didn't realise that she didn't love us. Of course she loved us, but she wasn't very demonstrative in that. And I would say that what I have consciously done is make sure that I'm demonstrative with my children. Mm. You know, let's face it, who doesn't love a hug? So I think probably that's what I'd say, what I've taken and what I haven't.
How much of that do you think has to do with the fact that you are raising your children in Spain, which is a very, you know, a much more physical society and culture than certainly the British culture? You know, people, at least until the pandemic, you know, you never say hi to someone without kissing them on both cheeks, you know?
True.
Do you think that's influenced you as a mother?
That's really interesting you've asked that. And until you said that, I probably haven't consciously thought. But when I first sort of fell in love with the country, I was actually living in Madrid. And I think that was one element that I was kind of seduced by, this open way of demonstrating affection for one another without any of that kind of awkwardness, certainly that us British tend to have. It's actually less so in Barcelona than it is in somewhere like Madrid, but definitely compared to, say, London, where I'm from, it's much more prevalent. And just thinking about my husband, who was brought up in a sort of a boarding school, public school background, and he's, you know, very, very formal in that respect. And I think certainly for him, he's felt much more relaxed being able to demonstrate his love with his children without it being awkward or, you know, just like, oh, you know, what are you doing up
right,
in my
right.
space?
Right,
So yeah, perhaps unconsciously that is the case. Yeah.
Yeah. I think one reason that Spaniards are so you know, relaxed and at ease with these displays of affection is that I don't even think they see them. I don't even think they frame them as displays of affection. It's just the way people act. It's like shaking someone's hand, you know. There probably are cultures where it's taboo to touch someone else's hand or touch someone else's skin. But for us, it's not a taboo. That's how you say hello to someone. And in that same vein in Spain, how do you say hello to someone? You just kiss them on both cheeks, you know?
Exactly. And it's so natural, which is so lovely. And mm-hmm. I think it's something to do with the outdoors as well, the sunshine. I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it does relax people and it does make a much more of a convivial environment. And you feel much more at ease being able to greet someone in that manner.
For sure.
So, yeah, it's great being around that sort of public displays of affection without the awkwardness that comes with it, with my background.
For sure. I want to circle back to your mom, Carrie, before we move on. You've lived in Spain for many years now, about the same number of years as I have. What was it like for your mother, if you know, when you moved here in 2003? Did she understand?
Yeah, I think she made out she understood. I'd always had wanderlust and I'd studied languages at university, so I'd lived abroad before. But I do remember her expressing that she was a little bit sad that I was leaving my career because I'd studied hard for my career. I was working in radio and television as a reporter and a presenter. And she was very proud of that, I think. And like so many of us, I actually only intended to go to Barcelona for a year or two. And we ended up staying. So once my husband got a job and you know, certainly once I had my own children, it was much more difficult to go back. And we did think long and hard whether we would stay in Barcelona or London. And I do often think what my life would have been like if I'd stayed. I think, you know, certainly from a career perspective, I think that would have carried on a much more traditional path. But I also think that, you know, I would have made, you know, close friends like I have today, if I have now. You know, they're like my surrogate family, like so many of us that live away from our own parents. But you know, it's only until you have your own children, isn't it? You think about how your own parents would think about certain situations. And I wonder whether, and she'd never say this to me, but it must have been really, really difficult for her. I mean, I'm thankful that I only lived in Barcelona, so I could go over relatively frequently to visit her and my dad. But I've got my best friend actually lives in Sydney. And I know for her, it's something that she cannot talk about, is the fact that once she left, and she was in her mid-20s at the time, and her parents were around for quite a long time after that, she was unable, you know, the connection kind of went. And I think that's hugely difficult. So, you know, my advice would be for anyone thinking about living abroad, think carefully about that distance, the travelling distance, that if you can get back quickly. Because, you know, things are a bit different now, obviously, post-COVID, but certainly it was fairly easy to be able to hop on a plane and get back, even for a weekend. So even though I wasn't living around the corner, it wasn't sort of, you know, time-wise that difficult to go and see them if need to be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm American, so obviously that trip is longer for me. But before COVID, you know, even though it is a long and expensive trip, and I never go back more than once or twice a year, but it's something that was always sort of in the back of my head, like a sort of a kind of quiet dread in the back of my head, like what if something happened and you couldn't get to your family? And then, you know, this unthinkable global pandemic befell all of us, and it happened. I couldn't get to my family. And so, you know, that is a reality. It is, it's sort of the great equalizer. You know, we're all humans and we all want to be able to either be near or have the option of being near our people. And, you know, when the pandemic happened, it really was a great moment of reflection for all of us. You know, this is not a given. It's not a given that you can get anywhere you want, anytime you want.
No, I think it's been a very interesting period for a lot of us. And, you know, I was very thankful that my parents weren't around during the pandemic for lots of reasons. But I also hope that it has made people realize the value of family. because, you know, you do tend to take things for granted, even if people tell you, you know, don't take things for granted until something major happens. That's just instinctive to be like that. So, you know, I hope that people will begin to understand more about, you know, seeing people on a regular basis, or at least just having some kind of communication with your family, because something as so unexpected, so random as the pandemic happened, and it you know, it makes you think completely differently. So there are good things that have come out of it, and I definitely think that's one of them.
Exactly, a silver lining. Well, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back to continue our conversation with my guest, journalist Carrie Frase. Back in a second. If you like what you hear on The Listen, why not check out our personal interview services? Tell your favorite stories, honor your loved ones, and record special memories before they fade. Your oral history is the perfect gift for grandchildren, parents, and partners. For more information, check out our website at thelistenpodcast.com. This is Kate Jetmore with The Listen. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Carrie Frase, who's talking with us about her experiences as a mother and a daughter. I really enjoyed reading hashtag Living the Dream, and I just felt I could see myself in so many of the women who contributed their section of the book. I think there are 9 women altogether, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
One that stood out for me was Jane Mitchell. There were just so many, but Jane comes to mind. She wrote about the change that took place in her life when her children weren't little anymore, right? When they got to that age where after she had spent 13, 14, 15 years being on call 24/7, suddenly her kids didn't need her in quite the same way, and she had to really adjust her focus and find, find a new sort of position in the world, certainly with regard to her children. Is that something that you can identify with?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Jane's kids growing up also ran concurrently with her getting a divorce. So her chapter is called Identity, Becoming Me Again. So not only were her children growing up, which was her main focus, but she had lost the role as a wife. So she really had to discover who she was again. She talks about it incredibly candidly. And of course, for all of us, that's an ongoing process. Sometimes we never truly know who we are. So actually, in some ways, and I don't want to speak on her behalf, but I know that she does see this as a gift in some ways, because sometimes you're not put in a position where that's the case, even though those challenges are very, very difficult at the time. You know, when you dig deep and you come out of it and you build your resilience and you really learn to be authentic, I think that's an incredible process, and how lovely to be truly aware of who you are. But going back to your original question about, you know, kids growing up, and obviously I think all of us as mothers, even though we might say otherwise, we do dread that empty nest moment. You know, for me, there's part of me that's really looking forward to having more time, because I'm incredibly busy with all sorts of things, including the kids. But you know, now that my kids are teenagers and they're at that stage, Well, personally, I know it's a different story for lots of people, but they're a real joy to have around. You know, that they can be messy, they can be a bit lazy, but they're generally really good company. You know, I love the fact that they're beginning to express themselves more, you know, more about the world around them, even though a lot of that's quite challenging at the moment. You know, generally, teenagers do have a lot of positivity, and I think, you know, there's really nothing better, is there, than being around people with positive vibes. We shouldn't forget that, and you know, that's much needed at the moment. So yeah, we can all as mothers, I think, identify with that feeling of losing our children. But I think what you have to do is just embrace the different stages of motherhood. You're always going to be a mother, isn't it?
Right. It just gets different, right? And also, I mean, if you look at it sort of holistically, that transition of your children getting older coincides with you getting older. you know, professionally, with regard to our, you know, in our marriages as well, with our friends and, you know, our bodies, like many things are shifting. And so that shift with your children is sort of one of many that occurs at this point of life.
Yeah, it's a really difficult time, I agree.
Mm. I also really loved reading about Avivit's journey. I loved the style that she wrote in. I kind of wanted to meet her. She's her energy just pops off the page. She talked about many things. It was a very engaging section. But one of the things she talked about was traditions and which traditions to celebrate and how to celebrate them. Because, you know, in the United States, when Thanksgiving rolls around, there are dozens of frozen turkeys in the supermarket and cans of pumpkin puree to make pie with. And here in Spain, I mean, I have to go to the butcher and order a turkey and tell him how to prepare it for me. And everyone's like looking at me like, who would order a turkey? Who is this crazy woman? You know, I'm the only person in this little town who's celebrating Thanksgiving. And actually, I remember I was reminded of something when I was reading Avivit's section about when my son started school. He must have been 3 or 4. He was in nursery school. And, you know, there are traditions like Thanksgiving that are very important to me that I go to great lengths to celebrate as accurately as possible in my home, and others that you just let go of. You know, Santa Claus is important to me. The Tooth Fairy was important to me, but the Easter Bunny wasn't. And so I never even told my son about the Easter Bunny. And one Saturday night, I was putting him to bed, and he was so excited, and he was saying, "Oh, I'm so excited about tomorrow morning." And I was like, what exactly are you excited about, buddy? And someone at school, I guess, you know, in English class, his teacher had told them about the Easter Bunny. And so he, thank God, he told me that he thought when he woke up, he was going to have an Easter basket. And so I said, "Oh, that is going to be exciting." And I gave him a kiss and put him to bed. And I went downstairs and, you know, put something together. I didn't have like a basket. I didn't have jelly beans. I didn't have, you know, that plastic green grass or anything. But I put something together and he was thrilled with it because he had no idea what an Easter basket should look like.
Oh, well done, Kate. You're a much better mother than me listening to that story.
Well, do you have any stories of your own? I mean, which traditions do you celebrate in your house? Which ones have you left behind?
Yeah, I think it's really hard, isn't it, to be able to get the balance between the traditions that you grew up with and the ones that your kids are experiencing around them. And, you know, in my children's case, they're at an international school where it's not just the Spanish traditions, but, you know, it's the Russians and the Chinese and, you know, the French. And it's, you know, it's very exciting for them. And I think that's great. It enriches their lives. But I think, you know, for my children, Christmas in the UK especially, they have always loved. You know, Christmas generally is a much bigger occasion in the UK than it is here in Spain. Obviously, that the King's is a more important date in the calendar. And they've always loved that. You know, I think it's partly because they're always surrounded by family and it's, you know, it's cold and cozy, so they stay inside and they watch television and they play games. And you're always here. If I'm at home at Christmas and it's a beautiful day, I'm not going to do that. Let's get out onto the beach. And, you know, for me, it's just exciting to do something different. And we have tried celebrating King's Day, but, you know, I think now they've grown out of it. I think, you know, a lot of the King's celebrations are quite childish, so they're actually not too bothered about that, and they're quite happy to have a pajama day, you know, at home while their Spanish friends might be celebrating with extended family. But you know, it's interesting, you're talking about your obsession to have turkey at Christmas, and I think, you know, when I first moved, I was really quite obsessed by carrying on those traditions because I didn't want my kids to lose that connection with my own upbringing, but I'm much more relaxed about it now, because actually this Christmas we couldn't get back to the UK because of all the complications with COVID. We were going to go back and we ended up going to France for Christmas, totally sort of, you know, unexpectedly. Hadn't really thought about Christmas Day, and we ended up making a pad thai, which the Christmas which the kids loved, you know, something completely different. It was a lot of fun. So I think, you know, ultimately it's about celebrating. The day is important, isn't it? It's about family and it's about memories, but perhaps the actual traditions associated with it, for me anyway, are not so important.
Yeah. It'll be really interesting to see what our kids decide to take forward, you know, just as for our parents, it's probably been interesting to look at us and see what we decided to highlight for our kids. I want to turn to Deborah's entry in the book. She, again, had so many poignant things to share and so many wonderful insights, but one that jumped off the page for me, Deborah and her husband are both professionals, and, you know, she's very busy, he's very busy, but they're both raising children together. And Deborah mentioned an idea that I had never even considered before, a prenup that is signed by both the husband and the wife that addresses the issues of responsibilities around child rearing to make sure these tasks are shared equally among both individuals. I would love to hear what you think of this idea and if you've ever heard of anyone putting this into practice.
It's brilliant, isn't it, Kate? I have to say that really stood out for me. When she sent me her chapter, I kind of reread that bit over and over again, and I thought, I wish I'd done it. And it makes so much sense because you don't have those like kind of, you know, those unsaids that you have between partners when someone's done more domestic duties than the other. It's very clearly laid out between the two of them. You know, Deborah's a very astute working woman, and she didn't want to find herself stuck in that default role of taking on most of the domestic duties. Like, let's face it, most of us women do. So, you know, she works out with her partner every week who is doing what with the kids. I mean, they on the fridge, you'll see the meal planning, who's picking up the kids when. And, you know, what that's meant is that she's been able to grow her business. Very important to her. Her business, like for many of us, is a reflection of who she is as much as being a mother. And that's been so successful. She's now running a company with, I think, more than 40 people in 3 different cities. But, you know, it does really help to have a partner who thinks the same way. I do think that, you know, a lot of men, they're quite nervous about giving up precious work time through fear that it may affect their career. Because we're lucky as women that we have different facets of our personality that define who we are. You know, we have friends, we have career, we have being a mother, hobbies. And I think for men still, it's still very difficult. What you do is really who you are. And so that's all about self-confidence, isn't it? And developing other areas. And she was just really lucky to find a lovely French man that agreed with that. So, you know, fantastic if it works. And let's hope that's the way that we all go.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's so great about this idea, because I know women who are very proactive in this way about, you know, and I think unfortunately, you often see this in a co-parenting situation where people have divorced and, you know, they sort of have to work out custody and have to work out, okay, on top of who's sleeping where, when, we also have to talk about, you know, ballet and piano lessons and camp. And so people in that situation, you have to be more pragmatic, right, and more practical. But one of the things I like about the way Deborah framed this was that she called it a prenup for childcare. And the reason that I think this is a great label is because by definition, it's something you're talking about before you get married. And so often, you know, we're all so in love and we're just thinking, well, you know, my story is the dream and it's all going to work out. And, you know, you have to talk about these things. And ideally, you talk about them before you're actually in it.
Yeah, because otherwise the resentment can grow as well. That's the problem, because you think that you're going to be able to get back into your career. And especially when you're living abroad, that's very difficult. You know, you've got the added challenge of being abroad and finding the workplace more difficult to enter. So I think you're absolutely right. So you don't really think about it at the time, but obviously as your kids get older and you want to be able to do more for yourself, and then you're suddenly seeing your partner, you know, full steam ahead in their career, You can build resentment. So it's, you know, maybe if you don't have a prenup, but at least have something in the bag that you know you can fall back on.
That's right. That's right. Well, let's take another short break and we'll be right back to talk more with my guest, British-born journalist, Carrie Frace. If you're enjoying this episode, check out our season 3 series, Coming Home, in which I spoke to couples living abroad who came back to their home countries to raise their children. You can explore our full archive by following us on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or Spotify. There are dozens of interviews waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and be sure to join our Facebook group, the Listen Podcast Community. And if you'd like to make a donation to the show or pitch a guest, you can do so through our website at thelistenpodcast.com. We're talking with my guest, Carrie Frace, about motherhood, daughterhood, and the importance of community. Carrie, before we continue, why don't you let our listeners know where they can find you, and we'll be sure to put those links on our show notes as well.
Thank you for that. Well, I think the best place to find everything about me is my personal website, which is carriefrace.com, where you can find out about my work as a marketing consultant. I've got a creative agency, Fig Communications, and also information on the book, which we've been talking about, and Mum Abroad, which is, as you've said, an online resource for international families in Europe. So yeah, I'd go there.
Wonderful. Well, I encourage anyone who's listening to the conversation, who's interested in having more information and you know, learning more about you and what you do, to reach out to you. Let's talk about mumabroad.com, which you just mentioned. What is Mum Abroad and how did it come to be?
Basically, I found myself in 2007 with a newborn in a city which I wasn't familiar with, without my extended family nearby, and I was pretty lost, to be honest. And I was with a very good friend of mine who was a marketing consultant. And as you've said, I'm a journalist. So we thought, well, how could we put our two skills together and create a resource that would selfishly help us? And that's what it initially was. We wanted to create something online where we could get information about, you know, where to breastfeed, where to buy the best formula for babies, where are family-friendly restaurants or beaches or day trips or all those resources that in your home country you know exactly where to go and how to navigate the various sort of resources available. And really, 15 years ago when we set this up, there was just nothing like that out there. I mean, absolutely nothing, certainly for the international community, but even for the local community, because I'm sure you're aware, Kate, that in Spain, who do you turn to when you've got young children? The grandparents, right? So
your mother.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that was childcare. The mother would be there on hand. And, you know, me and my business partner at the time, we were quite jealous of that. So we wanted to create a mother, which became the website. And actually, initially, it was called Barcelona Mum, because we set it up just within Barcelona. And it grew really organically. We suddenly found all these interactions and all these other lost new mothers out there that needed a resource. So we started to create something a little bit more professional as a website, and we started to put the recommendations from parents online. And then it grew from Barcelona to Catalonia, and then to the Costa Blanca, to Madrid, to the Costa del Sol, to the Balearics in Spain, and then 2 or 3 years after that we extended to France, Italy, and Germany. So really that's how it started. Actually started more as a kind of selfish passion project, if you like, and it's actually grown to become, you know, a fairly successful business, which we also help will help a lot of parents out there as well who still struggle, even though the resources there, you know, there's many more of them around. I think you still need that online community, which is what we've tried to create.
Well, even the image of mamabroad.com is very inviting. I mean, as a mother abroad, when I had a look at your page, you know, after our paths crossed and we set up this interview and I was preparing for the interview, I had the pleasure of sort of, you know, just exploring the website. And it's very, very welcoming. It's very easy to navigate and just a ton of resources. So anyone out there who's interested, I really do encourage them to hop on your page and just have a look and see, you know, see what's there. I think a lot of it, you know, you just said, you know, breastfeeding and formula, there's definitely stuff for parents of infants and definitely stuff for older kids too. I know one thing that I think you're involved with now in Barcelona has to do with, you know, like speech competitions and public speaking for teenagers. So, I mean, it really runs the gamut from very young children to older children.
Yeah, and actually, it's interesting you mentioned the public speaking competition, because 15 years ago, I'd never even think about including that on the website. But, you know, as my kids have grown up, so is the site. So the site's actually a little bit more professional and grown up, which started off as just, you know, really for little ones, because I had little ones, but we've still kept that information there for the, you know, the toddlers and the babies. But, you know, at the time, I didn't have a clue about what teenagers wanted, or you know, the tweens as well. And so now it does do the whole gamut, you know, up until the age of 18. And what we focus on as well, quite strongly, is education, and also that stage of education when you know your children are deciding whether to stay studying in Spain or to study abroad. I mean, that's a huge decision for them, and there's really no proper local resources for that. So to be able to have a perspective from people who've lived through it and know the stages they need to go through, the exams they need, the good university, and what you need when, and what the, you know, what the fees are. I mean, that's hugely helpful, because to do that kind of research on your own can be hours of work. So we do hope that we're helping that new demographic as well.
Yes, definitely. Well, one thing I was super excited to find when I hopped on the platform was all the resources that were there for working moms, from entrepreneurs to CEOs. I mean, there's a lot on there for, you know, women who are raising children and have a career. Why do you think it's so important for women to have access to these sorts of communities? I mean, community is always important, but why do you think it's so important when you're living outside your home country?
Oh, gosh, it can be hugely lonely as an expat. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't realize. And I think that's one of the underlying themes in the book. All the stories are different, but I think loneliness comes across at always for us at some stage. It's not always lonely, but it is, you know, it can be very difficult. You know, you don't have the automatic access to hundreds of different sorts of communities that the locals do, and that can be isolating. So online communities have become increasingly important, as you know, especially as we know during these last few years, and we're all very much in need to belong, to feel like we belong somewhere. And I think expats in particular, I don't really like the word expats, but you know, we all know what we mean when we say the word expat.
Yeah.
I think they in particular, we I should say, suffer from a lack of a sense of belonging due to the transitory nature of our lives.
Well, you mentioned earlier the word lonely. And in fact, there's a woman in the book, I actually can't remember her name, but she I think was from New Zealand.
Morag.
Does that sound familiar?
Yes, Morag.
Morag. I really, oh gosh, I just enjoyed them all. But there was a real longing to belong in her entry. And also a reference to something that you mentioned earlier, which is, you know, the road not taken. Like, what if I had stayed in my home country? What would my relationship with my mom have been like? Would I be further along a professional track, you know, that I might feel more proud of now? Would I be earning more money? Would I be more successful? And these are things that we can never know, right?
Yeah, and I also think it really depends on how you define success, doesn't it, Kate? Because we're all obsessed by career reflecting your success. And, it's a challenge living abroad, and you have to challenge yourself in so many different facets. And I saw a friend today, actually, in fact, and when she said goodbye, she just turned to me and she just said, "I'm so in awe of what you've done, you know, managing to sort of create this life for yourself." And actually, I thought, oh, that was really nice to hear. You know, you give yourself a pat on the back. It's because it is difficult. You know, I know it's your own choice. And what I should say to come across in the book was like saying, "Oh, woe is me," whatever. You know, you live abroad, you're near the beach or whatever. But I just wanted to give it a reality, exactly, a reality check. You know, we did choose this path, so you know everyone is in control of choice in their life. So you can't always feel sorry for yourself, but at the same time, you can still feel proud of yourself. But going back to what you were saying about Morag, and she challenges the issues of rootlessness and restlessness. And in her chapter, I do remember her alluding to the fact that she'll never be able to share a beer with her brother on a Friday night after work again. And that's something so simple, but actually really important. And you have to accept things like that. You just have to accept things for that, for other fantastic things. But, you know, you can't have it all, can you?
Well, and I think when you do accept it, it's not like resignation. It's almost like closing a book. You know, like when you read a book, whether it's a book that you've loved or a book that you haven't loved, it's over. And then you close it and you put it back on your shelf. And, you know, that's not a good thing or a bad thing. It just is what it is, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that feels like the kind of acceptance that you're describing. It's like, okay, that is not going to happen. And now I'm going to move on, you know? And it doesn't mean that, you know, tears won't be shed, but I do think that when you are very clear with yourself that, you know, what I have is this, what I don't have is this, life becomes easier instead of sort of, you know, tearing your hair out and obsessing about, well, what if I did have it? Well, what if I didn't have it, you know?
Sure. Yeah, looking forward, I think we need to change our chip a little bit about changing our obsession with the pursuit of happiness, but more about the happiness of pursuit, because you aren't going to tick every box, but you're going to, you know, it's the classic thing, enjoy the journey. And I think that's really what, well, for me anyway, gives me the fire in my belly, because there's always something ahead. So if you look back, you're going to end up regretting something if you think too much about it. But if you look forward, there's always an exciting challenge and something you can achieve.
Absolutely. And that's just so insightful, what you've just said, Carrie. I hesitate to even ask you this last question, which is whether you have any advice to leave us with as we wrap things up. I mean, you have lived abroad for 20 years. You've been a mother abroad for 15 years. Are there any words of advice you'd like to leave us with?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's key for people to understand that living abroad is not an easy path. It can be very scary at times, and you can be faced with many challenges that you may not have done if you'd stayed in your home country. But all these challenges, for me in any case, have definitely helped me grow, probably in ways that they wouldn't have done if I'd followed a more conventional path. You know, I hope, for example, that I've given my kids a really unique start in life. You know, they speak three languages fluently. They've got friends from different cultures. And also, I suppose that they have a sense that home can be anywhere as long as they're surrounded by love. So I guess, you know, in summary, it is all worth it if you do have a sense of adventure.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much for those words. Thank you so much for making the time to be with us today. I really appreciate your time, and I want to wish you and your family all the best.
Thank you, Kate. I really enjoyed being on the show. Thank you.
Next time on The Listen, we'll be joined by Jessica Lorien, host of the podcast Mamas in Training. Hope you can join us. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain, a UNESCO World Heritage Site since 1996. I want to thank Lisa Dahl, our web guru, and Julie Haley, who handles our social media. And many thanks to our technical team, John Jetmore and Lucas Munoz Jetmore, who make sure the show is ready to go each week. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is The Listen.